Three, two, one. That was awesome.
Right. That was awesome. That was really good. I'm Adam Davidson. Today is Wednesday, July 27th. But for those of you listening at home in the future, it's Friday, July 29th.
And I'm Alex Bloomberg. Today's Planet Money Indicator, 800. That's how many people we are so excited to be speaking to tonight at a sold-out show at the Sixth and I Synagogue in Washington, D.C. Thank you all for coming.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
So today on the program, we are going to give you the conversation that we at Planet Money wish was happening right now at the highest levels of government and news media. And it's also an answer to one of the most frequent complaints we get at Planet Money. And that complaint is, why are you guys so negative all the time? Why do you constantly talk about how awful the economy is? Give us some optimism. And so today, we have a really nice message for you.
And actually, you know how, you know, we're in D.C. right now, and there's this thing that I've always
wanted
to do.
Oh, no, right. Go.
Is that all right?
Go.
Okay.
Yeah.
My fellow Americans, the state of the Union and of the U.S. economy is strong. Well, really, it
nice.
Is.
That was nice. Yeah, good job. All right.
Thank you.
Yeah. I think it is weird that we've reached this point where the single most controversial thing we could say is that the U.S. economy, if you look at it in exactly the right way, precisely the right way, it really isn't that bad. Like, did you know right now, everyone says, oh, we don't make anything anymore. We're still the number one manufacturer in the world.
It's true. Nobody ever believes this. We are global innovators in everything from technology to toothpaste to Transformers movies. We have one of the world's highest per capita incomes out there. We have tons of exports, thriving manufacturing, jobs. And actually, this can continue for decades, this beautiful scenario.
It just requires one simple thing, a spirit of can-do compromise, bipartisan leadership in Congress. I stepped on that. That should have been really big
that's
laugh.
Right. Yeah, I know. Want to take it again? No.
Yeah, that's all right.
All right. So actually, anybody here work in Congress? Anybody? All right. So is that?
I see our lobbyists looking around.
That's coming, right?
Yeah.
All right.
So actually, this debt limit thing is a perfect example of the problem that we want to address. It's all this passion and drama about issues that are entirely artificial, with sort of this unembarrassed, unashamed self-destruction. In other words, Congress, we feel, is behaving exactly like an episode of The Jersey Shore.
Although, thank God, Harry Reid and Mitch McConnell have so far kept their shirts on.
So far, right. All right. So, but tonight, we're not going to talk about August 2nd, or is it actually August 9th, and is it a, AA rating, or this or that. We're going to place this whole thing in a much bigger, decades-long context, and hopefully help you understand what the debt limit means in a much broader picture.
Right. And so, we're going to back up, though. I said the state of the U.S. economy is strong, and it is, as we'll show you, but you're also probably saying, wait, unemployment is at near historic levels. There's underwater homeowners. There's Chinese-made goods flooding our stores. What about all that, right?
Right. And we know there is a very bad economy in the U.S. There's an economy with a lot of pain and joblessness. It's just that bad economy lives side by side right now with a surprisingly good economy, economy that even now there's lots of good jobs. It exports goods to the rest of the world. It does really well.
And that is what we're going to be talking about tonight. Not to get all John Edwards on everybody, but the story of these two American economies. We call it Broken America and American Dream America. And let's start with some stats. Unemployment, 9.2%. That is bad, and it's especially bad for certain groups. The unemployment rate is 10% for people with just a high school diploma. And if you're a high school dropout, it's nearly 15%.
So high school degree or less, you're absolutely living in broken America. America is not working for you. But let's look at people with more education. If you have a BA, your unemployment rate is just over 4%. I mean, that's
considered full employment. That's really good.
And for people with professional degrees, lawyers, engineers, the unemployment rate, the economic downturn doesn't exist. The unemployment rate is less than 2%. Economists say that's actually theoretically impossible.
Although, to be fair, economists are constantly seeing things happening in the real world and saying they're theoretically impossible.
So before we go on, I just want to do a little quick... We know from research that people who tend to go to public radio events in synagogues in Washington, D.C. probably are going to skew into the college-educated, category, which means you should also skew, if the data is to be believed, into the employed category. And we always love to verify carefully assembled, statistically rigorous Bureau of Labor Statistics data with entirely irresponsible anecdotal polling of our own. So if you don't mind, could we get a show of hands, anyone out there who, in this audience, who is unemployed? And we're just curious. And this is if you are looking for a job but you can't find one. Raise your hand if you are unemployed looking for a job and you can't find one. One, two, three, four, five, six. Six people out of 800.
Yeah, so that's right in line with a professional audience. And what we have to say to you is actually good news. For you, it's going to be okay.
It might not feel like it now, but statistically speaking...
right.
It's going to be okay.
It's going to be okay. The economy's going to grow. But for broken America, for people who don't have that skill, there is something much worse going on.
Right. Something really weird. A fundamental shift. So from around 1620 to roughly 1978, that's 360 years for people who are counting, there is this remarkable, unprecedented in the history of the world, unrepeated fact. The vast majority of people in America did better from one generation to the next. Now, of course, there were horrible exceptions throughout our history. There's slavery, Native Americans. But for most Americans, for most of American history, they did better than their parents, their children did better than them.
And that's the definition of the American dream, right? That the rich get richer, okay, but the poor also get richer. But sometime in the 1970s, that stopped.
Let's peg it at 1978, the year the American dream officially died. In retrospect, the signs were all around us. Everybody. This, of course, is Barry Manilow from his smash hit from 1978. And all the songs were this bad, in case you think we're not just cherry-picking the data here. Here's another one. This is one of five hits from that
top
from that
10
year.
Hits.
Top 10 hits by somebody with the last name Gibb.
So I think we have now statistically proven that disco did destroy America. All right. Now, what we're specifically talking about is a trend that began in the late 1970s and has continued to today, which is that for a large number of Americans, they saw that their inflation-adjusted wages either stayed flat or actually fell. And economists who always look for an opportunity to quibble do quibble a lot on this. They quibble on exactly why did this happen or how many people are affected or exactly how big the trend is. But the broad, broad view from left to right is that something big and fundamental has happened. For the first time in American history, for an entire generation, more than a generation, tens of millions of Americans, we put it at somewhere around 80 million possibly, are not seeing their quality of life improving dramatically from their parents. And their kids' outlook looks even grimmer.
And that is because, broadly speaking, there used to be two paths to the American dream. You could use your mind, or you could use your body. You could work in a factory. And you could do very well working in a factory. You could earn yourself a house, a car, a nice vacation.
And one of my favorite things about my job is I get to fly around the country and go to a lot of factories. I love going to factories. They still exist in America. They're still churning out lots and lots of things. But the striking thing is you walk into these big factories and you don't see that many people. What you see are really expensive machines run by computers. And the only people there have to be trained enough to understand how to fix those machines or how to program the computers that tell the machines exactly how to make stuff.
Right. And so factory work is now thinking work. And if some company does make a product that requires a lot of low-skilled workers, chances are they won't be American workers. So this has been going on since the 70s, but it's been sort of masked in this weird way. People aren't actually as aware of their declining incomes as maybe they should have been.
Yeah, because in part, earnings have been replaced by borrowing. You know, it's hard to say that the American dream is dead if everybody who wants a house can get a house pretty easily. A guy who embodies this for us is a guy named Clarence, who we met a couple years ago. He made about $45,000 a year, less in inflation-adjusted terms than his parents did. And he had three part-time, not very steady jobs, and he was able to borrow a huge amount of money.
Call it 540 for round figures.
You basically borrowed $540,000 from the bank, and they didn't check your income.
Right. It's a no-income verification loan. They don't call me up and say, you know, how much money? They don't do that. I mean, it's almost like you pass a guy in the street and say, you lend me $540,000? He said, well, what do you do? I got a job. Okay. I mean, it seems as if it's that casual, even though there are a lot of papers that get filled out and stuff flies all over with the faxes and the emails and all like that. Essentially, that's the process.
Would you have loaned you the money?
I wouldn't have loaned me the money. And nobody that I know would have loaned me the money. I mean, I know guys who are criminals that wouldn't lend me that money, and they break your kneecap. So, you know, yeah, I mean, I don't know why the bank did it. I'm serious. I mean, $540,000, a person with bad credit.
Now, there is a little bit of a story behind people getting home loans that they can't pay back, and that's not what we're going to go into.
We've spent a whole other hour, yes.
Hour-long talk. We've spent a lot of the last few years looking at that. But suffice it to say that this current crisis and the ending of the housing bubble has ripped away the thin veneer of fantasy that the American dream is available to anybody willing to work a full day, that they can get a home, get a car, have a better life. And I'm just realizing, Alex.
Yeah.
We set this whole thing up that we're going to tell them how to be optimistic.
I know.
And
we're
happy.
Doing great.
Yeah.
Now, how are we doing? How are you guys feeling so far?
Yeah.
All right. No, but we. Okay. So here's where the remember we said looked at in a certain way we can be optimistic, and so this is where we're going to start talking about that. So it's actually we're gonna argue not that hard for the people in broken America to regain the American dream. And the idea is basically to take those 80 million or so Americans who live in broken America, who have a high school degree or less, and figure out a way to get them into American Dream America. And we have a simple three-part plan to do that. Very simple. Are you ready? Step one, fix our nation's education system. Step two, fix government finances. And then step three, when you're done with all that, fix the nation's healthcare system. Once we do all that, problem takes care of itself.
Yeah, we're done. All right. So, all right. It's not that simple, but it's also not that hard, I swear. And we're going to explain this to you. So when you see terrifying news on the TV, not on the radio, we're always very measured, but when you see terrifying news on the TV and you start fearing that you or your kids are going to live in some apocalyptic hellscape of a global empire gone to seed.
Like England.
Yeah. Just remember, our problems are not insurmountable.
All right, so let's start with step one, education. All right, so there's this simple problem. For American Dream America, educated America, it's been really great that we've left factories. Educated people who work in services, they make more money. Also, your backs hurt less. Every once in a while, we get interrupted at our speeches by cell phones, but that's a minor problem. Compared to like losing a limb in an industrial accident or something like that. Like the factory work for educated America, for American Dream America, moving out of the factory has been good.
But for people without education, without skill, you know the drill. Leaving factories is bad, bad news. You know, Walmart, McDonald's, middle-aged people doing the jobs that teenagers used to do.
So one thought, we just take those 80 million people, the ones with only a high school degree or less, and we give them the skills they need to get better jobs. We train them. And for decades, just give them these skills to move them into American Dream America. And for decades, both Republican and Democratic administrations have promoted job training programs of this sort as a way of putting people to work. And the idea is really logical. There's only one problem. It doesn't work. At least according to a Nobel Prize-winning economist who studied this problem, a guy named James Heckman, who we talked to. And he conducted this study of the effectiveness of these job training programs. And specifically, job training programs aimed at young adults with a limited education. And he divided this population that he was studying into two groups. One group went through a job training program, one group didn't. And then he followed up with them to see which group did better at getting a job.
The results of these job training programs were especially disappointing. I mean, for boys, they would have been better off if they hadn't gone into the program. And for many other groups, the effects were basically zero.
So these programs were supposed to train you in a new skill that would enable you to get a better job, and when you looked at them, they didn't do that, and in some cases, they actually made it worse off.
They harmed people, correct. There certainly was no positive benefits. And so the general feeling that I came out with, I was quite depressed in some sense, because I really was hopeful, as were many, that such programs would have a big effect.
I saw this exact thing in action recently. I did a story for This American Life, a Planet Money story, in Rochester, New York, which is a perfect place to see what we're describing in action. Rochester has this economy that kind of surrounds downtown. It's Kodak and Xerox and Bausch & Lomb. It's these big high-end research facilities where PhDs come up with new ideas, and advanced manufacturing where people with high school plus some extra training, some technical expertise, make amazing products and live pretty well in the surrounding suburbs. And then you go to downtown Rochester, the center city, and it's some of the poorest neighborhoods in America. The Department of Labor spent several million dollars on a program called Pathways Out of Poverty. And someone pointed out that's a terrible acronym for a program with marginal success.
Yeah, I thought I was going to have to spell it out.
No, they got it.
It's acronym city here.
Yeah, exactly.
They know. And I went to their training programs, and a few things struck me. One is, as far as I could tell, every high school dropout in Rochester has been through a million training programs. There's so many training programs, they're just not training them for the right things. And what they don't train them for are the basic skills that they need. So the program that I reported on found that the things they needed to learn were things like it's important to show up at the same place at the same time every day. Surprisingly, it's really important to bathe if you're going to have a job interview. And even at that very basic skill level, what they found is the vast majority of people who came into the program, who were guaranteed a job if they stuck through it, dropped out before the program was over.
And this is what James Heckman found as well, that before you can even acquire like the technical skills that you need to succeed in the new economy, in American Dream America, you need this whole other set of skills. And Heckman, the economist, called them soft skills. These are sort of intangible, harder to quantify skills. Some of us might not think of them as skills at all. The way you interact with people, are you curious? Do you make eye contact? Do you smile? Are you open to new experience? Can you pay attention and focus? Can you control your temper? That's a big one, so that you don't get mad at people at work, but also you don't get frustrated and quit. These are skills that didn't matter that much in a world where brute labor could get you into the middle class, but today they're essential.
And so Heckman did these studies, and then he worked with other people who did studies, and he wanted to find out what's the point where it makes sense to train people in these skills. Technical school, turns out that's too late. High school's too late. Middle school turned out to be too late. Elementary school turned out to be too late. But he did find one incredible institution in America where these skills are taught every day.
I love trains. That's why I'm going to make a train.
You're going to make a train?
Yeah.
This is Professor Morton Siebler from Stanford, an expert in locomotive engineering. I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. That was Justin. He's three. And he's a student at the co-op preschool in Brooklyn.
And he is right now 3 years old. This is exactly the age where you learn these successful skills that turn out to be so crucial 20 years later when Justin wants a job. Preschool is what James Heckman discovered is the place to intervene to help people from bad America get into American Dream America.
Right, and there's a bunch of studies that he looked at, but one of the best ones is this pretty mind-blowing study. It's revolutionary. It's from the 60s, and it's called the Perry Preschool Project. It took place in Ypsilanti, Michigan.
And so what they did was they took a whole bunch of kids from poor families, and only 1% or 2% of the families had ever been to a museum. These were poor families, and they were randomly selected to go into one of two groups. One group, they did nothing. They just stayed at home, lived their life. The other group got 2 hours a day, just 2 hours a day of preschool. Not even a special preschool, just an average, decent preschool.
It was a good preschool, actually. You were freelancing there with it.
It was actually a pretty good preschool. Okay.
Yeah. It's a high quality preschool. That's important.
All right.
But both groups at 5 years of age, they went back into the same Ypsilanti public school system, and they just basically lived the rest of their lives. So from kindergarten to graduation from college, from high school, for those who graduated, they were in exactly the same milieu. There was no more intervention. And then the researchers followed up with these kids when they became adults. And the difference that preschool made was utterly astounding. So, and Heckman's going to use the term control group and treatment group in this tape that you're about to hear. The control group was the group that didn't get preschool. The treatment group got preschool. And at 27, the boys in the control group, non-preschool, they got arrested a lot, more than two times each boy. But in preschool, the treatment group?
In the treatment group, that was cut in half.
Wow.
You look at monthly earnings on the job, the control group is earning about two-thirds of what the treatment group is earning.
So 20 years after getting 2 hours a day of preschool, they're getting arrested half as much. They're earning a third more money. I mean, preschool clearly will pay back in dividends over your entire life.
And there was a whole bunch of stuff like that. Like the girls who got preschool, when they got to age 27, they were 50% more likely to have a savings account. They were 20% more likely to have a car. Again, 2 hours of preschool, 2 years out of their lives when they were 3 to 5. Preschool kids got sick less often, were unemployed less often, committed crimes less often, went to jail less often. And the results of several other studies back this up. And this raises, for me, one of the biggest questions. What in the world is going on at preschool? You come here every day? You come here every day? Oh, wait, I asked an expert. You come here every day?
Yeah.
And when you come here, what do?
I don't know. I just don't know.
My favorite piece of tape that I've ever gathered. That's Ella. She's a three-year-old who... at the co-op school in Brooklyn, and every once in a while during our interview, she would twirl around like a ballerina. She's not from a disadvantaged family. Her parents are paying money to send her to this preschool. But what goes on in this preschool in Brooklyn is very similar to what went on those 2 hours a day back in Ypsilanti in the 60s at the Perry Preschool. And Ella's teacher, Eliza, was actually better able to explain what exactly that is.
They play in the morning. And then we'll sit down and have like a morning meeting, which is where it's just like kind of gets them into the routine of the day, which involves like doing the weather and doing the calendar and like just having general conversation about what we might do during the day. We play outside, then they take a little nap.
So I hung out here for a morning trying to see, like, what is going on here? What's making this happen? And it's a lot what you'd expect. Kids painting with paint sets or building stuff with blocks. You have to look really, really hard to find where they're learning job skills.
I'm using that one. Kids look at it. Not even can have just one.
But you can hear it. The kids are learning these crucial lessons, how to resolve conflict, how to share, how to use words to get what you want. In other words, these are the exact skills that get you to succeed in an American dream universe. It all starts right there.
Right. And here's the thing. If you don't get these crucial skills, these are the skills that enable you to learn later on in life. If you don't get them in preschool, it's really, really hard and really expensive to get them later. As the people at Poop can tell you, I'm sorry, Pathways Out of Poverty can tell you, it's really, really hard.
And really expensive.
And really expensive.
So if we all want America to thrive in 2030, it's in our interest to make sure that the kids of the people in the broken America get to go to a decent preschool now. And there is some good news on this. It's not going to cost that much money. I mean, the thing is, kids in the American dream America, most of us, we send our kids to preschool anyway. So there's not a lot of intervention to be done there. And how much would it cost to get all the underprivileged kids in America into preschool? It's a bargain. It's $14 billion.
And Heckman, who is an economist at the University of Chicago, says this doesn't even have to be government money. It can come from foundations, from church, from synagogue programs, whatever, as long as it comes from somewhere.
And I always point out, education of poor people is a classic, what economists call a public good. It is in our interest, for our own selfish reasons, for them to get a better education. They'll pay more in taxes. They'll be better citizens. They'll invent cool gadgets that we can buy.
Which you really love. I know. I sit next to him. He's constantly getting a cool gadget delivered to his office every single day.
Steve Jobs can't do it all.
Yeah. All right. So that's step one. Get those 80 million people with a high school education or less, get them educated. And preschool is a really good place to start. Of course, elementary school and high school are important too. But the point is, relatively speaking, it's not a lot of money. And in terms of bang for your buck, it is a no-brainer.
And Alex actually has a brilliant plan to fund this directly. Alex used to be a middle school teacher, and his proposal is we just eliminate all education between the ages of 11 and 13, because they're not learning anything. And just use that money between the ages of 3 and 5.
Honestly, I catch up with my students later, like now they're, 30 or something, and I run into them. I was like, do you remember one thing I taught you? One thing. And they can't remember anything.
All right. So we're not going to get into, there's some other issues with education. We'll leave those alone. Solve education, the future's ours. All right. And then speaking of no-brainers, we're going to move on to solution number 2, U.S. government finances. And here's the second most controversial thing I'll say. They really are not that bad. They're not that good. Don't get me wrong. I'm not crazy. But they're not like hide shotgun shells and gold in your basement bad.
Right. So our government debt right now is roughly 100% of GDP. Roughly that means we owe as much as all the people and businesses and government agencies are spending in a year in America. And that's certainly not good for the long term. We all know that. Generally, if you look at the data, something happens when a country gets above 90% debt to GDP, when that's a bad line to cross.
It seems that when countries spend a lot of time above 90%, they tend to, there's no pretty way to say it, they tend to collapse.
They collapse.
Yeah, but here's the thing. We have time. It doesn't happen immediately. And it also tells us we don't have to get the debt to GDP to 0% to be reasonably healthy for a long period of time. We just need to get it below that 90%.
70% debt to GDP, that would be great. We could live with that for years. Get it down to 45%, we could probably be fine forever.
So we are saying that all this Sturm und Drang you hear on the TV, all the people poking you in the chest saying the Fed is about to collapse and gold is the only thing of value, it's over a problem that really is utterly solvable. How do you do it? There's obviously proposals from Democrats, proposals from Republicans, and in a big macro picture, it doesn't matter all that much. We know that you're going to have to cut government spending. I'm sorry, but it does seem like you'll probably have to raise some taxes, certainly get rid of those loopholes.
This is, I think you put the I'm sorry before the wrong thing in this crowd. I think you're saying, I'm sorry, we have to
raise... Oh, right. That's public.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
But Social Security, defense, all these like sacred cows, there are plenty of solid bipartisan solutions that might involve a little bit of pain on either side, but they don't seem insurmountable, truly.
And then there's Medicare. All right, that one does seem kind of insurmountable, right, if I'm honest.
That one's a little hard.
That one's pretty tough. And that brings us to issue number 3, solution number 3 for America's long-term competitiveness. All we have to do is fix our healthcare system.
All right, now this is a very thorny problem, obviously. But even here, when you step back, there are some pretty obvious truths that we think pretty much everyone can agree on that don't get out there in the main debate that often. And one of the main truths The way we get our health care right now, that we get health insurance from our employer, that is really, really weird.
Employer-based insurance is a horrible system. I mean, why would you want your employer buying your health insurance? Why on earth would you want your employer buying your groceries? You certainly wouldn't want that.
So that's Melissa Thomason. She's an economist and economic historian at Miami University of Ohio. And she helped us picture this. Like, what if we got our groceries through some program that our employer gave us?
Yeah, you'd have your employer-based food plan. And first of all, so if you didn't have a job or you had a part-time job without benefits, you wouldn't get food at all. You'd be really, really hungry. That would be awful.
But if you got like a great plan, like I'm sure NPR would sign up for the Whole Foods plan.
Yeah.
You bring $20 copay and you get to take as much as you want. It'd be fabulous.
Right. And keep in mind, you would never see the price tag on the stuff that you would buy at the register. So if someone asks you, for example, I love my fancy Belgian beer, like I unfortunately know the price tag, but somebody would ask me, well, how much does it cost? I'd be like, I don't know. I spent $20.
And the weirdest thing is, no one sat down and planned our system. This wasn't someone's idea. It was a total accident, actually a series of historical accidents. And there's a bunch of them. It's not worth getting all the way in, but probably the crucial moment comes during World War II. Back then, the government was really worried about inflation being another burden on a war-torn country, and so they said, no companies can raise wages. But this is exactly when there's all these factories that need to churn out all this material for the war. All the young men have gone off to fight that war, and so these companies were really stuck.
You can't find workers. Can you imagine in today's environment? You can't find workers who can work for you. You can't lure them by increasing wages.
And at the same time, you need to produce enormous amounts of stuff for the war effort.
Right.
And
yeah.
You're
exactly.
Losing all your young, strong men.
Right.
Exactly. You know, so what's a poor employer to do? They turn to fringe benefits. And they just started offering more and more generous health insurance plans and pensions and everything else, actually.
So before the war, 10% of the population had employer-based health insurance. By 1953, over 60% of the population did. And then responding to lobbying, the government enshrined the employer-based system into our tax law.
And not only does that drive up costs for a healthcare system, create a very skewed, unequal system, but it does this other thing, which is really bad for long-term competitiveness. It locks people into jobs, usually jobs at larger companies. And for our country to grow and prosper and do well, we want people with good ideas to feel comfortable taking a flyer and starting their own little business or going to work for their crazy cousin's startup.
To produce gadgets for you to get delivered to you at work.
Please.
Yes. And so we have this crazy historical accident of a system, and it's not really a free market, it's not really government. And the good news, here's the good news, almost anything would be better. Single payer where the government provides insurance to everybody, a largely market-driven system where you would buy insurance the way you buy everything else, cell phones, computers, cars, either one would probably get rid of the inefficiencies that we have right now into our system.
So we're being fairly glib, running through three of the most intractable issues in America, but what we're trying to explain is when you put these programs and when you put these issues on a spreadsheet, when you do the math, it really is solvable. It's solvable in a way that most Americans would feel okay with some compromise. And that is not something you can say about most of the other countries in the world. I mean, people are very afraid of China. But for China to truly become the dominant economy, they have to pull something off that is really, really hard, and nobody has quite done it yet. They have to completely transform their political and economic and probably their social system to accommodate a much broader, globally interconnected, to switch from an export-led to a consumer-led economy. That's really hard, and when you go to China, it's not clear they can pull it off.
And then there's Europe. We don't know where Europe is exactly. This big common currency experiment is not going very well at all. It's not clear how they're going to sort things out. That's a really big, intractable problem.
Go around the world. Japan has more than double the debt we have and not really a credible plan to pay it off. There are many promising emerging economies, of course. You know, India, Brazil, but they have a long way to go before they're anything like a major competitor for us.
And we're not saying this to sort of say, like, look how much better we are than the rest of the world, but to try to put our problems in perspective. Our problems really are Jersey Shore problems. You know, if we just cut the drama just a little bit, it wouldn't be as much fun to watch on TV, true, but on the other hand, it might just ensure a healthy future for us and our children. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Line up. If you want to ask a question, just line up. And we were told to walk around because there's people who can't see us.
Yeah, but
we forgot.
We forgot, and yeah, nervous. Sorry. Yeah. Hi. But we're walking around now. So yeah. We would love to take question and answer.
And I guess no questions from people. This is American Dream America, you guys.
Yeah, Invoke America. Yeah. But you guys already knew that. That's why you're up there.
Yeah.
We'll start.
Yeah, first of all, I'm really glad to be here. I live in California, and I'm only here for the week, so I just got lucky.
Excellent. Oh, great. Welcome.
The question is regarding the preschool. I remember reading these articles online, and my first thought was that it's not necessarily the preschool, but the comparison to the home environment.
Yeah.
Do you know of any studies that compare, say, the American Dream America kids
in preschool?
Who went to preschool versus those who didn't?
The studies are really, really hard and expensive to do because you have to start in preschool and then you have to wait 25 years and then you have to follow up. So that's like there's very few studies in that, but there have been economists have found other ways of studying it. Like you study kids who go into preschool when they're two versus it's long. I won't get into it. It seems like data suggests that even for middle class kids, preschool has an effect, and I think most middle class families know that. I mean, do you know how expensive it is to send your kid to preschool? It's certainly in New York. I mean, you know, the market is pricing that value in. But I think it's absolutely true. Like there is for a lot of kids who aren't getting the proper stimulation in the home life, that's what preschool does. But even for middle class kids, there's some effect that it actually does help. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. And for poor kids, it's clearly protective. We know that.
Yeah, it's absolutely. Yeah.
I mean, obviously, nothing beats the full package, right?
But, yeah.
Well, yeah, I was just thinking that there may be less expensive, or, I mean, obviously it's a bargain, as you said, but there may be other ways to do something similar, because, it's all tied together, right? If the parents can't work or they're not working, and, you know, it's going to be harder on the kids if they don't have health care, and people who aren't in American Dream America are more likely to lose their job if they get hurt.
So there's no question, and I mean, I think obviously the more that you can do, but I think the point of this is that in terms of like what if you had to choose your dollars and do one thing with those dollars, right. There's a lot of I mean, Heckman certainly believes that the return on the investment, like he thought of everything in terms of return on investment.
Absolutely.
Return on investment, sending a poor kid to preschool is pretty much the highest ROI you get. In terms of a social program, in terms of like the cost that you save later on, in terms of incarceration, all that sort of stuff, and in terms of the added earning you get from that kid.
Right, if only we could turn all those private prisons into preschools, we'd be all set.
Yeah.
All right, thanks,
Great.
A lot, guys.
Thanks.
Hey, guys, thanks.
Hey, sure.
Kind of in a basic way, debt ceiling.
Yeah.
I mean, are we going to be like on August 3rd, like an A&E reality show where like the repo man comes and takes Obama's limousine and Boehner's going to be crying in the corner because his house man is taken? I mean, what's going on with this?
On August 4th, we will all die. That's all I know.
Yeah, I guess we buried the lead.
Yeah. And to be honest, we're not the people for this debt ceiling thing. I mean, our editor, Uri, is here somewhere, and I think he's a little annoyed at us that we haven't weighed in as much as we should. But we cover economics, and this is not economics. It's a political theater. And... So other than, like, solve it, you know, we don't have a lot to say. But we will say, I mean, it is definitely true, if they don't solve it, bad things will happen.
If they don't raise the debt ceiling,
bad things will happen. And, you know, looking at data, you can tell a story that it's not that terrible. It would mean 50 to 80 basis points. I'm looking at Antoine, who knows this much better than I, but it would, you know, add a bit to interest rates over a period of time, and it would be tough but not destructive. And you can tell a story that it would fundamentally shatter the faith in the U.S. economy in a way that will mean we will all be a bit poorer for the rest of our lives.
I don't know.
The one Antoine? Thing you can say is whatever the size of the wound, whether it's a relatively small wound or whether it's a mortal wound, it would be entirely self-inflicted. So
yeah, there's no real issue here. There is no real issue here.
Going back to the last part of the story that you guys were telling about the rising healthcare costs, you know, I'd never heard the part of the story that employer-based healthcare contributes to the rise in healthcare costs. It's usually the aging population or the rise in specialization. So could you guys go a little more into detail about that? Like the dynamics.
Like the dynamics of why does having an employer-based system make health costs rise?
I think I could do it fast, hopefully. So by creating a tax incentive for employers to offer health insurance is cheaper. You know, they can buy a dollar of health insurance for you, but you've experienced it as like having a dollar or 30 cents in benefit. So it encourages and incentivizes through government fiat employers to offer more health insurance than you would normally get. So people who have it are overinsured generally. And the health insurers, to compete for business, aren't competing for us. They're competing with HR departments. So they're offering a set of things that keep HR departments happy. One of the end results is those of us who have it, when we pay for our treatment, we're cut off from any kind of financial decision. Unfortunately, in my family, I've gone through a bunch of catastrophic illnesses recently, a few cancers and stuff, and I was really thinking about this, that obviously with my family, I want them to live. I want them to have the best possible treatment. But just because I'm an economics reporter, I would explore how minor shifts in decision-making for equally good treatment could mean the difference in hundreds of thousands of dollars spent. But if I wasn't actively pursuing that information, it never would have come up because that was completely opaque to us. And so you get into a big issue. You know, some people do believe healthcare is a right and people shouldn't have to think about money. But we do know from economics that if that's the case, then the price will continue to rise dramatically. So I don't think anybody or very few people think we should have a system where everyone just pays a la carte. I mean, there should clearly be some risk pooling, but there are a variety of ways you can do it where we experience the economic signal without being overburdened by it.
Right, and so it just gets to the point of just sort of like how important like the cost of something is in sending a signal, you know, and that's the thing that is like totally missing in healthcare. Like you don't know. The person who's experiencing it doesn't know. And then it goes through the insurance company, which is going to the employer. So there's sort of three steps of between the signal. The signal gets muddy. It goes from the hospital to the insurance company to the employer to you. And by the time it gets, you know, that circuit is just very, very muddy. So it doesn't get communicated back. Like that's too expensive. You don't even know how much is too expensive. So the incentive for everybody is to sort of just like raise the cost.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, everyone's fine. The cancer.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Just so you know. So they were treated well.
One of the things I value about Planet Money is not only that when you explain the U.S. economy, but when you go abroad, and I'm thinking of stories like on the Spanish banking crisis or the Iceland referendum. And so I was wondering, you spoke a lot about the U.S. today, and I was wondering if you could kind of look at the opposite side, and to what extent do you feel that when you look at the global economy, that the problems we have here are out of our control? Or what things do you look at outside of the U.S. where you feel like this is something that other countries have a real impact on how the U.S. is going to be going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think most of the things, leaving aside global warming, which is obviously an impossible thing to leave aside, but that's so big, I'm not sure how to account for that. But I feel like generally the rest of the world getting wealthier is good for us. Like I don't think there's any debate about that. More people who we can sell stuff to, more people who can sell stuff to us. The more disposable income there is in the world, that's better for everybody.
And the view that I get, Antoine van Achtmaal is here, a friend of mine who coined the term emerging economies and is a very important guy in emerging economic finance. You know, he's helped me understand, and others have helped me understand. This is, when you look out 30 years from now, when there's a Brazil that's as rich, that's richer than we are today, an India that's richer than we are today, when basically much more of the world is a lot more like us today, we'll probably still be richer, but that's a better world. That's a politically more stable world. There's more compromise. But getting from here to there means we do become a smaller, you know, we're still probably the dominant player for a while, but we lose some power. Other people who aren't used to having power start stretching their muscles, and some countries that we maybe aren't too into having a lot of power do have a lot of power. So it's a bumpy ride, probably, as we've noticed. But the end destination should be a much better one. All right, I'm so sorry, but yeah. Thank you guys so much.
Thank you.